Wong, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 37, and today I'm joined by Matt Jordan, assistant professor of film and media studies in the College of Communications here at Penn State. His work focuses on jazz, pop culture, and French culture, and he has written recently a book entitled Le Jazz, Jazz and the French Culture Industry, which was published by the University of Illinois in 2009. And we'll put a link up on the website for that. So he joins me today on the Digital Dialogue to talk about his recent article in the Journal of Music entitled Don't Upset the Rhythm, Innovative Music as seen, it is seen as a moral threat. And this will, I hope, frame a larger discussion of the impact of media, and specifically social media, on human habits. The impetus that led me to invite Matt to the Digital Dialogue is our ongoing conversations we've had in various contexts about the impact of social media technology on our students and on ourselves. So it's a pleasure to welcome Matt to the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
So I would love for us to begin by talking about this article in the Journal of Music, Don't Upset the Rhythm. So maybe you could just sort of frame that a little bit and say what you were arguing there or talking about there.
A lot of my work has come to surround the idea of how culture, pop culture, is used to have debates about morals, mm-hmm. about the direction of society, and about values in general. And I've become increasingly interested in the way in which these debates about popular culture have come to take the place of, in many ways, what philosophy used to do. Instead of having explicit dialogues about these things, we have them through whether or not we like certain cultural phenomena or not.
Right.
And so this is the piece in the Journal of Music was trying to look at a history of how the music was seen as something dangerous to society, and to think about when a music is seen as dangerous, why it is seen as dangerous. And mm-hmm. that's essentially the theory behind this, which is that when music is heard as being disruptive, then it usually allows for a certain kind of projection as to what is disruptive. So again, this takes the, instead of having an explicit debate about what is good for society, you talk about what is dangerous for society, and in particular, in this case, rhythm. So, you know, this is something that dates back to the Greeks. Mm-hmm. Plato famously telling the musicians to pack up their instruments and head out of the Republic because the way in which music inflames the passions was thought of as something that was dangerous to something like a public dialogue or something like a rational political discourse.
Mm.
So I try to examine the ways in which the various thinkers have thought about this relationship between music and the ethos being what in the kind of more Roman cognates that we use, think about as mores, social mm-hmm. mores. So right. the Greeks talked about the ethos as being this kind of combination of psychology right. and social order.
Right.
And
right.
when music was introduced into that, often it had a right. disruptive impact. You know, a lot
right.
of cultures don't let women dance, for instance,
right.
and it's usually because of that concern that this medium is so powerful that it can lead people right. astray. So you have a variety of folks in the ancient Greek world talking about this, some of them more conservative than others,
right.
some of them more reactive against music than others. And we have analogous debates today. I used this figure to open the piece of Big Bob in the movie Pleasantville,
mm-hmm.
which essentially is taking up Plato's view of these mm-hmm. things, which is that only stuff that is soothing to the ethos
right.
can be allowed in something like a Demos,
right, mm-hmm.
And that the rest of the stuff, in this case Dave Brubeck
yeah.
and Elvis Presley,
right.
has to be excluded from that. So there are many examples of this type of debate happening in relation to popular culture, where, again, what cultures tend to do is develop ways of describing what they think is dangerous for
mm-hmm.
something like social mores or
mm-hmm.
the ethos of
mm-hmm.
a people by talking about which kinds of music they think are dangerous. In the end, I think this will, you know, please your listeners who are used to the Aristotelian bent and things. Aristotle was probably right on these things when he said that it's really not as much the music or the specific capacities of the music, but really it has to do with our having the kind of cognitive frames through which to understand this stuff. So that if we don't have a way of understanding what the music is and what how it acts on us, we tend to have a kind of a dangerous danger Will Robinson signs go off everywhere, and we tend to react against it in that way. So once we develop these cognitive frameworks or linguistic apparati through which to deal with music, it becomes pleasant. It becomes staid. It becomes acceptable.
So, I mean, at the end of the article, you do gesture to Aristotle and talk about it's the innovative dimension of music that really is the issue. But I'd like to talk a little bit more. We probably ultimately will when we come to the question of social media and all that, about how that assimilation happens and what gets lost in that process when music is assimilated. But I wanted to just go back for a second to the Greek notion of music and the dangers of music. This goes back to a thinker by the name of Damon, who Plato does refer to in, or have Socrates refer to in the Republic. And there the link, as you mentioned, is exactly right, that there was a concern about the impact of music on character, and Damon was somebody who said, okay, look, the rhythmic, harmonious kinds of music will be able to cultivate moderation, temperance, these kinds of traditional Greek virtues in people, and, you know, there are other forms that will, as Socrates himself talks about, the Dorian form helping, cultivate courage in people. And I like the fact that you pointed to the Spartans, who actually played calming music before battle to calm the nerves. So I think that's a longstanding point about the Greeks. In fact, we could even play it out in terms of the mythology, because there's this story about Apollo and Marsyas, a satyr, who Marsyas playing the flute, which was associated with the irrational, the passionate, the sexually over the top, whereas Apollo, of course, playing the guitar, the kithara, played, you know, harmonious music, rational kinds of things. So you see that already mythologically playing out in some of the themes that you bring out with regard to jazz, particularly in France and other places. So you played it out also, I guess, in terms of Rousseau, some of the things Rousseau was talking about.
Right, and that does point to this kind of, and this is something you see in people like Hegel and in people, all sorts of folks who talk, things that are ordered in music tend to be okay with, whereas something like melody, you know, the guy on the flute, or, you know, I guess you could even say, you know, the myth of Orpheus, he's the first rock star. The screaming Bobby Soxers ripped him apart because his music was too seductive. That you have this, things that are leading the mind away from notions of order as opposed to bringing it to order. I mean, we see these things working out in our culture all the time, right? The geniuses behind the baby Einstein convinced the world that Mozart would turn their kids into Harvard graduates, and it was very saleable because of that. So you have these things, and again, this I talk about this debate, famous debate between Rameau and Rousseau, which was a debate that goes on still today in music theory, which is that music that kind of relates to these natural Pythagorean cosmological orders is real true music, and the other stuff is this more disruptive thing, the stuff that Rousseau liked to think of as being melody, which was then the basis of true language and all of these things like that. So
actually, point just to follow that up a little bit, because the story of Apollo and Marsyas is interesting, because Marsyas is about to beat Apollo with his flute, and Apollo, realizing that it's something associated with the voice and with the breath of life, starts to sing with the kithara, and that's actually what allows him to defeat Marsyas, and then he has him flayed alive, you know, in this beautiful, you know, typical Greek kind of thing, you know. But it's very interesting, the role of the voice and the human voice, given what you just said about Rousseau and language.
Right, yeah. You know? Well, it's almost, Apollo's showing early on the power of hegemony in battles over music.
Exactly. Well, and he brings up the issue. I mean, I wrote an article called The Politics of Music where I try to play out what Socrates is actually doing in the Republic, and I do want to just mention something about that because I want to, I try to problematize this. This traditional sense that, well, Plato banned the musicians and thought music, you know, was dangerous, or just limited music to this kind of thing, that Plato was this kind of hyper-rationalist guy. I tried in that article to argue that, you know, if we pay attention to what Socrates is kind of up to in the Republic, and we don't take at face value some of the things that he does ban from the Cydian speech, you get a really interesting dynamic where the erotic dimensions of music, and particularly Socratic music, his playfulness and his ability to get people to think differently about their lives, becomes an important part of what the Republic is. And it, at least in that article, I argue that Glaucon is able to recognize that precisely because he says he's an expert in erotics in some ways. So it's, well, that erotic dimension.
Well, I think this erotic dimension, I'm working on a piece right now on the Obama We Are One concerts, and in particular the use of music as a kind of effective rhetoric or effective tool in the creation of kind of what I'm wanting to characterize as kind of post-political populism.
Uh-huh.
Post-political in the sense that there's a disconnect between the affective structuring of the message, which through music, in particular with Obama, he is the guy who, first political figure who put out a soundtrack to the campaign and used it to raise campaign, and his taste in music. There's a lot of writing on what was on his iPod.
Right.
And these concerts were very carefully constructed to marshal affect in a way that would take some of the traditional signifiers of politics, which have become emptied of significance, things like hope, change, love, the things like that, and to kind of reanimate them with his own kind of personal taste. So musical enjoyment and the way in which this type of, it is libidinal for sure, this attachment that we have to it can be very powerful. And again, it's bringing us back to Plato. It's not that I think that Plato was a fuddy-dud, but that he recognized
for sure
the importance of these things in turn and what they could do to people, to take them away from something like a, you know, to turning them into the, you know, the women who ripped up Orpheus.
Right, exactly.
So that this is the issue. And again, in my work in the French context, then, I've tried to see how these debates about what was dangerous or what was good about the music play themselves out. Now, the French have this great phrase that they like to use a lot. The music should adoucir les morts, which is soften, soothe the moral, something along that line. But this tends to be something that the conservatives like to see in music, that it's going to kind of soothe people. It's kind of the political Muzak that is going keep them, you know, dutifully staring at the wall in the elevator and not pounding against the walls of the elevator to get out, which is what the more kind of progressives tend to like in music. They like its capacity to move people to sometimes revolutionary behavior.
I'm just going to your current project with regard to the Obama and the post-political, what did you say, post-political populism and the use of music. I like that. The use of music for that progressive push, is that how you see that, or do you see, and maybe what, I guess I'm having my sort of a conflict in myself about the just, you know, basic propaganda techniques, which in some ways this is, but also, you know, the use of music to control and render docile, versus the use of music to move and animate and invigorate. Now, of course, you know, the Nazis used music too to invigorate and move, right?
And work quite effectively. What I'm interested in is this is a kind of a beyond the guard type piece that I'm doing right now, and it's the perils of post-political populism. Not only because I like alliteration in the titles, but
that must be why I like it.
But because it does both. Both the things you're describing. It both has all of this kind of mass psychological element that people have been worried about since the 19th century in terms of dealing with politics, you know, the fear of the crowd.
Right.
And because it can move people to do good things. Populism is, I'm reading this Ernesto Laclau book right now on populist reason, and it's interesting that he's doing something different in discussions of populism, which is not to say that it is there's a difference between rhetoric and ideology, or the use of signifiers and what you're trying to do with them, which is the traditional way to think of it as a Machiavellian technique to move people.
Right.
But to think of it as a constitutive logic. And so what I'm trying to do is think about the musical aesthetics and what they do as a way to understand some of the paradoxes in the constitutive logic of again, post-political populism. Post-political is a term that people have been using in political theory for a while, because governments are moving. The European government was what? The European Union was what stimulated this, that actual decision-making is done by technocrats in Brussels, and the elections that are done are these kind of spectacular things done for the consumption of national audiences more than anything, that have a growing disconnect between policy and what we would think of as mass politics. And this is what I think the fear is with Obama. Now, there's a couple things that I'm doing in this, not only working through my growing ambivalence about the Obama administration, but to think about the kinds of music that were used. Now, there was a lot of ballyhoo in the We Are One concert. I don't know if you've seen it. It's on YouTube. It's the only thing that is allowed to be that big on YouTube. It's it's an hour and 58 minutes. It's shown in its full entirety and was originally disseminated free by way of HBO and whatnot. And this was, again, at a time when there was a lot of writing in newspaper about the list of things that Obama was listening to. So this, and it was billed as a celebration of Obama's musical taste. Now, what I'm interested in is the way in which there's an assumption about somebody's musical taste and what kind of guy they are, right? And that since the leader in our kind of national imaginary often stands in for the desires of a people, understanding what somebody's musical tastes are tells you a lot about who that leader is, or at least, and this is, you know, again, the technique side of things.
Sure.
This is, you know, just like Hitler loved him some Wagner.
Right.
Obama likes him some Motown.
Right.
And so but the kinds of music in the We Are One concert were, you know, and this was done on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in this kind of space that has been baptized by many populist movements that have come to march on Washington.
Right.
And in fact, during the spectacle, which was done by the same guys who do the Grammy shows and the Kennedy Awards honors, and it was staged in that same type of format, they were constantly alluding to March on Washington or during the Great Depression when Marian Anderson was the first black singer to come and sing on the Lincoln Memorial, etc.
Right.
But the kinds of musics that were used were the kinds of music that the culture industry uses, you know. And again, I'm not going to go on my Adorno rant about popular music and say that it is merely attempts to kind of pander to the lowest common denominator, and that's what's democratic about it, is that it hits all the low, you know, not in terms of baseline, but in terms of the, you know, the baby,
you
love me, baby, that anybody can imagine themselves into, and that this is the kind of music that they chose, which was not, in traditional sense, what populist rhetoric does. Populist rhetoric, for instance, at least all the effective ones, do two things. One, they identify the political movement through the leader and his tastes, desires, etc. And other, they identify an enemy. And this is what all the effective populist movements did in American history. They identified a problem that would unify people. So again, this constitutive logic in terms of using the populist rhetoric to unify a disparate people. And this is what the music doesn't do. So the music that is used is like the late Bob Marley, One Love, Let's Get Together and Be All Right, which is very different from the Concrete Jungle Bob Marley that is identifying very specific social struggles. This is the kind of hypostatized sentiment that the culture industry thrives on, because everybody can project themselves into it. And so what I became interested in is that one of the recurring themes of Obama's rhetoric and of the oratory, both of Denzel Washington, the only other black star in America with the same kind of gravitas as Obama's orbit, they kept saying, it's about you. You know, So what I'm interested in thinking through is that there is a problem when populist rhetoric and populist movements are individualized. Now, I've been thinking about this.
Individualized meaning focused on an individual figure like an Obama.
No, individualized in terms of focusing on the individual listener.
It's about you. It's about you.
So this is something that I'm using a little bit of writing about 19th century mass religious music. And this thinker I like, Slavoj Žižek, has used this term radical subjectivism to talk about the religious music of Verdi and Berlioz and Wagner in the 19th century, which was that in the waning of actual religious sentiment in the 19th century, what they tried to do was kind of reawaken religious fervor by appealing to people through massivism. So there was a kind of technical showdown. Say, the analogy best is probably best described through thinking about what happened in the Requiem masses of the 19th century, which were commissioned by rich people who were worried they were going to hell, usually, which was that they kept getting more grandiose. So Verdi introduced, you know, trumpet choruses all around the hall and made it a surround sound experience. Berlioz invented new, bigger bass drums that could be thumbed and create this kind of disconcerting kind of shock effect, which, you know, Nietzsche accused Wagner of so often, that would then kind of do this appeal to massivism, but was still about the individual experience of the aesthetics. So it wasn't really about a genuine collective experience of religion. It was about the experience of massivism. So that this radically subjectivized experience of the music, in that it's about how the individual gets overwhelmed by the spectacle, was a shared one, but it was still one that was about you and the spectacle. And that this is kind of problematic in the same way that it's problematic toward trying to reconstitute an authentic religious movement. It's also problematic in terms of trying to do I'm suspect of these words authentic, but an effective, maybe, or a less problematic mass politics. So a lot of ballyhoo was made in the We Are One concerts about Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger reintroduced what could have been, I think, the effective polemos, or enemy of the populist movement here. He did This Land Is Your Land, which was a Woody Guthrie song. And it was Woody Guthrie wrote this piece in reaction to Kate Smith doing God Bless America, Irving Berlin's kind of, you know, very culture industry friendly nationalist anthem, because he thought it was too complacent. It was, you know, had no, and so no oomph. So what Woody Guthrie had originally done was had this this song which talked about all the problems in America during the Depression. And in the first month or so, maybe my timeline here may be apocryphal, but very shortly after the song came out, there was a stanza in it that it got lost. And the stanza was about private property. And the stanza goes something like, "And before me I saw a tall wall, and before that wall was a sign. On the one sign, on the front of that sign said private property. On the back of that sign there was nothing. That sign was made for you and me." So it identifies the problems in America as stemming directly from banks and private property, which could be, in today's environment, a very effective polemos for to quilt a populist movement around. But that was here and gone in this concert. So a lot of
did Seeger sing that verse?
He sung that verse, which has since been reintroduced. I think, you know, Sharon Jones and the Dap Dap Kings has also done another version of this song. It may have even been on the Obama soundtrack, one of them, that also had that verse, which had been gone for 50 years from this song. So a lot was made of that, but that went away, and it got replaced by the dominant concept of this is all about you. And this is all about you is not surprising for a mass political movement to be based around.
Particularly in the United States, where this atomic individualism is, you know, operative at all times, right? You can't appeal to I mean, if you're going to appeal to all as one, you have to, in some ways, do it in this kind of radical subjectivist way that Zizek talks about, because, you know, the idea that we're sort of not in having our own experiences, that we are really linked in a way that, you know, is more intimate than we might recognize, is something you have to contend with as a, in American politics, right?
Right. This is the era that, I mean, Times Man of the Year last year was you.
Right,
you
know, exactly.
Prosperity theology, where you're supposed to have a personal relationship to my Jesus. You know? So it's this is part of the ethos in which we live, is this radically subjectivized world. But the concern is that you can't really have a motivated collective body, because just like Adorno talks about, these musical gems, you know, so steeped and dripping with memory that they are, don't have a common meaning. You know?
Well, I mean, and the thing that I find also interesting about what you're suggesting is, you know, if you take the notion of traditional populist rhetoric and say one component was this common enemy. Now, it's one thing to... Now, there was some dimension of that in the Obama rhetoric with the Bush administration.
Right.
But
politics as usual.
Right. Politics as usual, exactly. But you always had the sense that he was... His real interest was sort of moving beyond that and getting to this sort of common sense of what we're trying to do. Now, you know, he's had limited success in doing that as a president, or at least moving us in a far enough, at least in my opinion, way. Mm-hmm. But of course, we have to take into consideration the constraints that he's, you know, that we're all dealing with, and with the structure of the institutions, first of all, and second of all, the backlash of all kinds of Tea Party politics and all of that. So, but what I find, I mean, there is always a potential problematic about having that polemical other. It's one thing to talk about banks and banking, but, you know, certainly in Nazi Germany, the other became the animating force of that kind of, if it was ever a populism, I'm not sure. But, you know, that polemic moment is fraught with issues.
Yeah. And again, it's in my reading of what has happened and why you like this term post-political is that the... what I think was genuinely populist candidate Obama, you know, in terms of using this grassroots movement based on these ideas of hope, change, and, and common shared struggle against something, was replaced by hiring, you know, this politics as usual became politics as usual. It became the same technocrats that had worked in the Clinton administration, Larry Summers.
You saw the consolidation after the...
And this is where the disconnect between political rhetoric and political machinations, actual workings of government, happen. And that's why I think what has happened is that this affective relationship that was established, the way in which this music and the oratorical themes structured our relationship of feeling to the political movement... it also sets up the feeling of betrayal, because those things are so... our hopes are projected onto them. If it's all about you, the thing I hope for and am deeply cathected to in that kind of a Freudian libidinal way, becomes things that if you tear me away from those, it's going to hurt. I'm going to be angry. So it's, you know, again, I'm not...
When you're talking about the anger on the left rather than the anger on the right, that is from a different source, right? It's not from disappointment. It's from, you know, wondering what happened to our country, so to speak. But let's go back then to, because the Benjamin has been now haunting me since you've been starting to talk about shock and because that you bring it up in the in your article, the notion of jazz as having that shock effect of what Benjamin in the work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction calls the shock effect, and he's there talking about the relationship between traditional art forms, painting and film, right? And for Benjamin, the issue, the power of and the importance of the shock effect for modernity is, and for the modern subject, let's say, is the habituation to the quickening of images and the fast moving pace of modern culture and the ability to then be prepared, a heightened presence of mind against that shock, mm-hmm. which Benjamin saw as positive in the sense that it took us out of that passive, receptive, contemplative approach to art, mm-hmm. which I see as this kind of dynamic at play with the concert that you're talking about, but also in, let's just take the example of jazz in France, because that's mm-hmm. what your article was talking about, where there is this... where there's this docility or the ability of music to make one docile and passive versus the kind of rhythms and music that I think jazz has, which is can be unexpected, which can be mm-hmm. Jolting in certain kinds of ways, disruptive, dissonant. But that those moments of dissonance, that disruption, is exactly what we... in modern society need to be prepared for in a certain way, but also that's one side, be prepared for, and there's something then that's lost when the innovation or the newness of it wears off and we have assimilated it, mm-hmm. right? There's something that then is lost, right? So it's the fact that it's on the one hand we have to be jolted and prepared for that jolt, but what happens on the other side? What happens when that newness is not assimilated, or we resist the temptation to assimilate the novelty or the innovation? Right. And this is related to some of the things I've been thinking about cultivating a certain kind of openness to being surprised, mm-hmm. to a certain kind of shock, without moving immediately to assimilation.
Mm-hmm. This is the great vexing problem. And so, you know, Benjamin wrote that in reaction, that piece in reaction to, I mean, this is a really interesting part of Benjamin, is this very kind of Marshall McLuhan side in his early writings when he was still kind of working on phenomenology, really.
Right.
Where he really thought that each medium has its own mode of consciousness that goes
right.
along. So.
Right.
The print culture, and it creates a mode of consciousness, and when we get to film, what we see is this jarring new way of experiencing and perceiving the world is brought to us, and you can't go back, basically.
Right.
The kind of impotent cries by art critics that
right.
we need to return to something more contemplative is useless in the face of something
right.
that is so compelling in a narrative and kind
mm-hmm.
of mm-hmm. erotic way,
yeah.
in a sense, with film, that you can't convince them through better rational arguments that
right.
you need to stop being so into film. And that this is a really good way to think about media. Now, Benjamin's, you know, cure for this was, you know, fraught with problems as well, which is that he thought you had to use it, right? So in that essay, he says you the trouble with this type of shock effect, right,
mm-hmm.
is that it can lead to fascism, which
mm-hmm.
is what
mm-hmm.
the Nazis had used it in terms of mass politics to do. He saw the problem with the art in general, art critics and critics in general in Europe, was that they somehow didn't want to get sullied with the new media. They wanted
mm-hmm.
to stay pure from it,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to stay, you know, kind of unpolitical, art for art's sake,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. if I can
right.
say.
Sure.
And instead of embracing this new shock effect and trying to use it. So I think Benjamin would ask us to think about how these new media
mm-hmm.
create new modes of consciousness and ways of, you know, I like his word, aperceiving the
mm-hmm.
world.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, to be very on guard
right.
about what those things can
right.
lead to
right.
in terms of modes of consciousness that can be very dominating.
Right.
So there's this one thinker that Benjamin was very conscious of, this guy Georges Duhamel, was a French
mm-hmm.
guy who was
mm-hmm.
notorious conservative, wrote some great articles about the radio that I've come across.
Uh-huh.
But this guy was, you know, he made this very compelling argument that the danger of cinema was that it led, instead of say one sitting before a work of art and having, you know, your mind lead the next association that it's going to make, what cinema did through editing was lead our mind down a path in a very passive way, as mm-hmm. you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that this, Benjamin was very compelled by this argument, but mm-hmm. didn't think that the answer to this was to, you know, withdraw right. to contemplative
right.
old art, but that you had to actually use this. And this has, you know, become a way of thinking about media for me that is, you know, again, right. fraught with right. the dialectic, because right. there's always something lost when you're when you're moving things forward.
Well, and I think that the issue, I mean, with the issue in that article, in that essay on the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, and the notion of the decay of the aura is powerful, because the decay of the aura of the work of art is, for Benjamin, first of all, it's not the destruction of the aura. The aura still sort of remains operative in a certain kind of way, but there's a positive. There's a positive side to it, which is this putting us on a heightened presence of mind, and the question of the way the shock effect and the way film certainly in Nazi filmmaking was in some ways the appropriation of those of that mode. And the minimization of the shock effect to a certain degree, right? And so that the degree to which I think Benjamin saw the power of that heightened presence of mind as a way of addressing the tendencies of that, and or the way that fascist movement could appropriate these new art forms. But I guess maybe this is a good segue to the discussion we've kind of been having, you know, over email and in various different places about sort of what is the and how one should respond to all these new media, so particularly the social media phenomena that we're witnessing. What is this? And you know, I found myself thinking a lot about that when I was reading your essay, because I sort of, and part of me felt like everybody who says, oh, all of this new media stuff, Twittering and Facebook and all the fragmentation of things, is problematic. We need to get back to the book. We need to get back to all. I felt like, okay, here are the people who are against jazz, who are, you know, on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, let's not be naive about the impact of what these things are what's happening
right,
here.
Right. The social media thing, again, to kind of link this to Benjamin's idea that each medium has a mode of consciousness, mm-hmm. and that. That's going to determine the way in which we receive the world. So I think what Benjamin asks us to do is to think about the ways in which these media make the world available mm-hmm. to us mm-hmm. and how they create certain spaces for certain types of associations to happen. The way I've been kind of coming to this, and this is through our discussion about habits,
right.
which I find very compelling, both as a heuristic device, just to think through these things. Right. What would be good habits that one could have?
Right.
And I think what I worry about, and this is coming from somebody who's done an online course and is trying to integrate these things, is that the shock effect has been unleashed, right?
It has been, and it is
powerful. It is as Benjamin would call it, has a dizzying effect
right.
on people.
Right.
But it is being utilized by a vicious consumer hegemony,
mm-hmm.
if
yeah.
I can use that
no,
word.
Sure.
And that, you know, so one of Marshall McLuhan's ideas that I also find compelling is that the medium itself is the message.
Mm-hmm.
That the content of these media isn't exactly incidental, but it is secondary to training us to like that media.
Mm-hmm.
So music. Music's message is music.
Mm-hmm.
It trains us to want to hear more music.
Mm-hmm.
Film's message is film. We want to see more film. It's training us in certain habits
mm-hmm.
of using these media. So what I worry about is that we are becoming, to sound kind of Marcuse-like here, one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
We are a society that is increasingly being apperceiving the world through one kind of media. We have students now who email is too old-fashioned for them.
Yeah.
Everything has to be text message
mm-hmm.
because that's the way they deal with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what I worry about as this works into the academy is what habits are we training them? Yeah. Because it seems to me, you know, I was thinking about this actually during graduation, during the, you know, the alma mater. Helpless, you know, here the people, students come unmolded. And we here at Penn State are supposed to mold them who were, you know, helpless before their fates. The fates of modern society mold them into being new media people. They mold them into feeling a sense of anxiety and fear when they can't immediately connect to the world. And so that is the dominant habit that they have when they enter dear old state, is to be molded in such a way as to expect that immediate visceral connection to information. So the medium as the message is that they need to be connected. And you, we've talked about these various studies that have come out, and this, I have a couple of graduate students right now who are working on the trope of addiction being used to think about social media. And I, like you, am a little suspect of this word being applied to media. But that recent, you know, University of Maryland study that talked about how when people described what it was like to go without their social media, sounded like addicts. That they generated a great deal of anxiety. They felt disconnected, even though they were in a campus filled with 20,000 people. So it seems to me that when we're thinking about the habits, I mean, I see, and I'm sure Aristotle sees this as well, that there is a need for different modes of being, right? Different kinds of habits. You know, like Marx talks about, the ideal society would be one where one's a fisherman in the morning, bed breaker in the bed, you know, bread baker, and then, you know, hunter. These are different modes of being that are part of being a whole person. You know, Renaissance man type way way of thinking. My concern is that we have this hegemony of new media that, though connected and though very shocking and very easy to motivate students with that shock effect, leads them to not have certain kinds of habits. And this is again my Benjaminian anxiety about the way this leads us into certain modes of consciousness that can easily be appropriated by the most viciously consumeristic world. I mean,
I guess there's a couple of things about that that I'm I want to think a little bit more about. I mean, I share your concerns, and I guess on the one hand, the McLuhan point is right that the medium is the message. On the other hand, I feel like, and McLuhan I think also recognized this in his later writings too, saying that actually it's a much more dynamic relationship, that we are determining the technology and the technology is determining us, and we're in this kind of interesting interesting play. And I even talked about it, I guess, as the medium is the massage because of that that give and take, right? And so so I guess from my perspective as an educator and as someone who is interested in not only what's happening, what do these new media mean, and what affordances do they give us, and what limitations do they have, but I'm interested in two things. One is sort of more philosophically. I see the emergence of these social media technologies in particular as just the next stage of an ongoing human attempt to reach out to one another in new and more diverse kinds of ways. So in that sense, I think it is, I do see the danger, the Marcusean danger of one dimensionality. But there is a way in which the plurality of ways of expressing oneself in these medias, be it through video, through you know, text, through audio, there's an increased diversity that actually could have the opposite of effect of that one dimensionality. So that's one point. But the other one is, as an educator, I want to take seriously the idea that, well, it's not just that the technology is doing this to us, that we can form it, use it, and shape it in ways that will push it, you know, to have a multidimensional dimensionality to it, that can cultivate in our students and ourselves the values that we want. And I've been associating those now with the, you know, traditional values of the liberal arts of openness to diversity and a more global perspective and a comfort with ambiguity and an increased ethical imagination and those sorts of things. I think that a danger is when those media are just sort of left to be taken over by the commercial interests, mm-hmm. which clearly they are being, mm-hmm. Or even the sort of, you know, political interests in a traditional sense of political, mm-hmm. then we, you know, what is the role of the educator now? And I think the role of us has to be to be in this in some way, helping to shape what's happening here.
Right. And you can correct me on the ins and outs of my reading of Socrates, but Socrates, as far as I understand, made a distinction between education as kind of mm-hmm. vocational education, mm-hmm. training people with sure. certain skills, and higher education being that which teaches virtue by confronting people right. with the things they're afraid of.
Right.
So again, to think about that a little, if the thing that our students are most afraid of is not being socially mediated,
mm-hmm.
what is our role then to be higher educators and not just teaching them to mm-hmm. make widgets?
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I think this is the peril of academia as it's become more consumer-oriented yeah. to give them what they want.
But
instead
see,
of saying, you don't right. know what you want, let's right. force you to right. confront
but
going
see,
without.
But see, the thing about that, though, is, I mean, what about the faculty? I mean, the faculty... That if it were animated by that concern, if this sort of recalcitrance to some of the new media stuff is, we're animated by, oh, let's make students uncomfortable, or let's challenge them to be in a medium that's different from what they're used to, then that would be one thing. But there's a fear of the new. There is an unfamiliarity of what's coming, what this means for them, for us faculty. That is, it seems to me, is driving a kind of regressive and
sure.
reactive approach. Now, so that's one thing. The other thing that I would want to say about that is, and it's interesting, is I feel like in a certain way, in some of my classes where I've used blogging and some of the social media formats, students are made uncomfortable by the format being used in this educational, robust educational way, and them being forced in a way to articulate themselves in a clear, concise way. All the things that we would associate right with good writing,
right?
So there's a way in which, you know, the discomfort comes in. Well, it's not just me texting, you know, what I think, what I feel. But it's this community of accountability that can emerge,
and I think that is right along the lines of what you know we should be trying to do
right.
with it. Again, the concerns to with me is that if we were trying to create kind of, you know, we're two people who spent a lot of time reading monographs,
right?
Years of our lives,
right.
alas,
right.
were spent reading monographs. So that's a kind of mode of being that we're comfortable with.
Yeah.
And I think that many academics are comfortable with. And the data suggests that the new generation is almost incapable of doing. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, where I start to think about this relationship between behaviors that are attributed to this type of use of a media. The way in which we relate to the world and the way it shapes then our, mm-hmm. our modes of perception and understanding are very fast, been very reactive, kind of
mm-hmm.
Have a second-order indexicality and less of a sign creator type of world to it. So there's this reading of that Deleuze does of Nietzsche that may or may not be right. Some people claim it's not right, but I kind of like it, which is that one thing that Nietzsche focused on as a problem of modernity was that modernity created reactive thinkers,
mm-hmm.
not creative thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
So that what we're doing constantly is reacting. Now, I know mm-hmm. in my own use of social media, and I'm a Huffington Post junkie,
mm-hmm.
and you know I do my fair share of this stuff, is I'm constantly reacting to whatever it is that the hegemonic forces of culture
mm-hmm.
have put there for me to react to. And what I need to tell myself every once in a while is put the crack pipe down, right? Go think about it for a second.
Sure.
And this is, and again, in terms of instructing people with certain types of habits
mm-hmm.
that lead to a more, you know, and I liked your
mm-hmm.
definition of the pursuit of happiness along these lines
yeah.
as well, that it's really about cultivating happiness through good habits.
Right.
So if if what we're trying to do is get them to pursue happiness by having good habits, I think it is imperative that we keep these things in mind as we're using new media. Right. Now, if you go to some of these seminars on new media and whatnot, what you hear a lot about is potentiality, and it usually goes something like this. It's really cool, this thing.
Right.
And look at how they're having this huge back channel conversation up here.
Right.
It's drivel, but there's a lot of action going on over here. Right. And the connection is needs to be made then between feverish activity, which is made possible by the affordances of the media, and the kind of actual creative work or productive work that can come from that kind of thinking. So again, I'm a holistic kind of guy here. I want different modes of being, different types of behaviors.
Right.
So I think we really still need to, along with trying to use new media in innovative ways like you're trying to do, to get them to actually, you know, articulate things and stake themselves in a public way.
Right.
We also have to tell them that, you know, take a class in meditation. Yeah. Learn to be by yourself and be okay with that.
Yeah, right.
Which I wonder if they can do now. I don't know if you, has it become an, kind of sociological behavioralist exercise I do that I've been doing for like 4 or 5 years now. As you walk through campus, how many people don't have a telephone or a PDA with them?
Right.
And are using this to manage their relationship with the world.
Right.
Don't want to look awkward, not talking to anybody, too much social pressure, act like you're on the cell phone.
Right.
Try to do this. And again, all the hegemonic forces out there in culture want us to do this. I read this interesting article in Forbes magazine, of all places. It was my optometrist's office, and she had that. And while before my pupils had been dilated, I learned that digital cell phones had made talk very cheap, that the traditional format of cell phones, reaching out to somebody and talking so they can hear the quality of the voice and whatnot, there was no profit in that anymore because the digital spectrum had made it so cheap. So the big drive by the big telecom companies is to get people hooked up to 3G because then they can start charging them again.
Right.
So they've been trying to do this for about 4 years now to convince everybody that if they can't get access to the latest YouTube clip or can't get their immediate fix, that they are not a whole person, that they are miserable, and that all of them. And so that also happens to be the same rhetoric that you see in higher education, right? And this is when I worry about that. So who's driving the bus here?
Mm-hmm.
Are we instructing students and instructing, you know, again, land-grant university we work at is one in which we're supposed to instruct the citizenry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to be creating people who can be productive members of society, not reactive members of consumer culture.
Right.
So this is where my ambivalence.
Yeah. Well, and I share that ambivalence, but I also feel like the power of some of these things. I mean, even the power of what we're doing right here. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to do a podcast, because of the voice, because of the fact that I get to have face to face conversations, or at least slower conversations with people that can teach me things, and we can have interesting conversations that I hope push us in new directions. But and then have a public that we would never have had we just sat here together and had a conversation. Now, our conversation probably would be somewhat different, too. I think that the addition of the microphone and the potential public that will be out there adds a certain kind of performative dimension to the way we're talking to each other, which I think in some ways is good. I mean, I've had some of my best conversations with my colleagues, including this one, because, you know, I've said, okay, let's come and let's do this. And so there's something really powerful about that. And that's, I think, what I'm thinking more about is how can these social media technologies be used to create communities, to build communities, and cultivate communities of relations where we are responding and responsive to one another in a rich way, and in a way that brings us closer to some kind of truth or some kind of conception of shared understanding.
Right.
And I think, you know, thinking about the monograph and the reading, I'm really getting excited about the idea of being able to. So, yeah, you're right. I've spent so much time reading and taking notes, and, you know, but that reading has always been mostly passive in a certain way. Obviously, you write papers and you write books, and, you know, but the possibility of having a reading experience where you are really able to be an active reader and engage in a dynamic way with some of these, you know, even PDF files and books and things, and then maybe even share those with a community of people you begin to trust and can learn. I mean, there's a lot of really powerful possibilities here that are not necessarily about consumption in that hegemonic popular culture consumerist way.
Right, right.
I share your worry that, you know, and one of the reasons why I decided to take the position of associate dean here in the College of the Liberal Arts is that I worry that what's driving our adoption of technology is efficiencies, cost saving, expanding the population of students who will pay tuition and all that. Now, that's going to be part of anything. Mm-hmm. But really, what has to be taken seriously, I think, is the what affordances these things offer us and what we as educators, if we learn what they mean, and part of that means using them. I mean, I've found that I can talk about a new technology, but until I play around with it a little bit, I don't understand what it could do for me or what its dangers and possibilities are. But we need to be driving that bus a little bit. And the pedagogical practices and the values and the virtues and the habits that we should be cultivating in one another and in our students should be what we're pushing to.
Yeah, so long as we can still read monographs in the morning and bake bread in the evening, right? So we can do different types of activities and have different kinds of habits.
Yeah, I think the both end point is important. That, it's not that this is going to replace that
Well, I think what everything would suggest is that it can't, right? That, I mean, again, this has been a Samuel Morse was the guy who came up with actually the global village idea. And this has been a kind of this what one scholar, James Carey, calls the electronic sublime in communication discourse, which is that there's always been a thought that the newest technology is going to kind of the problems in society are problems of communication, that we just haven't been able to connect, and that the newest technology is going to make us all into one big happy village, like John Dewey kind of wanted us to be. Nice New England,
there you go,
chatting around the square. And every time we've realized that this isn't really quite the, but it's always the fantasy is there, the social fantasy that somehow that this is going to do it. And I think what you look at in terms of looking at how social media works, how social networking works, is you also see how it doesn't work. It shows is that the relationships created through social networking, through this type of media, are always secondary to something that is more real. And again, I'm using that word for the listener at home with scare quotes. It helps support the relationship, but there has to be something primary there that the social networking and the new media is in the service of.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not very, doesn't work very well. I have a student who just finished a dissertation on the social networking sites for people who are kind of transcultural kind of laborers of the kind of white-collar variety in Europe working for companies, the kind that our study abroad programs churn out and draws, these people who are of a certain age who can be sent out anywhere into the world. And they feel all alone, and the great hope for companies and through institutional organizational communication is that these social networking places can make up for the fact that they've been deracinated and sent to Paris. And what she found was that they don't work very well. People still feel the need for face-to-face community.
Yeah, I mean, my own experience with Twitter and with blogging has been a deepening of my relationships in the very local community. I mean, it's really, there are people far and wide who can see some of the stuff and who may participate, but it's really been my relationships with students here on campus that, learning things about what they're doing that I would never have known about otherwise. And even with blogging, it's been people who, hear me talk and then we get into a conversation and that'll drive them to comment and then we'll get into a large... So it does feel, at least the way I'm trying to use it, it does feel more personal, or at least rooted in those relationships, rooted in real relationships. Right. And even people who I've just sort of met virtually, there can be real things said, and it can be a space of real, genuine communication.
Right.
But I do think it can also, it also lends itself to, as every media does, to manipulation, to this, these hegemonic forces you're talking about.
Well, you know, I'm planning in this class I'm going to teach in the fall on opening things up like you have said you've had good luck with, and I have great hopes for the type of creative work, I hope, that can come out of this. So I do want to explore ways in which, again, to come back to Benjamin, in ways in which this shock effect of the new, the way in which this kind of creates a new subjectivity and a new kind of mode of consciousness in relation to the world can be used for, you know, kind of positive ways, and instead of, you know, to mollify and
get
people to spend 24 hours a day in front of a screen.
Right.
And I do think there are hopes for that, but I think it's the great challenge as we use this more and more to figure out a way to have some kind of disciplinary function so that we can instruct people in better habits and not just give in to their cravings.
Right. No, exactly. Well, maybe after your experience this fall, we'll have another digital dialogue and talk about what worked and what didn't work, because I think there's all kinds of really interesting things that are possible, and also limitations that we've also seen. So thank you, Matt, for coming on the digital dialogue.
Glad to do it anytime.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under Creative Commons Non-Commercial Share Alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.